And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us, Utah Avalanche Forecast Center Director Mark Staples. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Leslie. With an upper Cottonwoods with 3 to 4 inches of new snow overnight, that'll greatly improve riding conditions. That's combined with some strong winds the last couple of days that smoothed out the snow surface. Overall, though, the avalanche danger is moderate for triggering a persistent slab avalanche, and that'll be at mid and upper elevation slopes, generally on the northern half of the compass, northwest through east facing. Today, especially watch for ones that are heavily wind-loaded. Also, with a little bit, a few inches of new snow and some moderate winds, also watch for fresh wind slabs.
Okay. Hey, thanks. KPCW News Time now. KPCW News Time now, 8:11. Good morning. Joining me now in the studio with Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, let's see, I guess really the only topic you've got going on is the effort to save the Oscar Thorpe family ranch that still has not been settled. Where are we at this point?
That's right. We still don't have a final deal with the county, but we do have a little more breathing room, maybe, it looks like. The long and the short of it is the county made a new proposal at the end of January, and that was the result of a lot of ongoing discussions with the family and the county. Unfortunately, the proposal was not acceptable to the family, and so we don't currently have a deal with the county. What we do have, though, is we've had tremendous community support for this transaction, for saving the farm. And because of that tremendous support, we believe that we might be able to actually buy ourselves a little more time. We've been talking for a long time about the March obligation that the family has. They need to make a big payment as a result of an inheritance that they have to, an obligation that they inherited. And so they have to make a $5.5 million payment to an alma mater. And so what they had hoped was that they would be able to, you know, save their farm and sell a conservation easement on their ground and then be able to relieve themselves of this burden. So that payment is still waiting to be made out there. But because we've had so much community support, the family is willing to take out a loan for a portion of that payment. And then in combination with the funding that the Summit Land Conservancy has raised, that will be enough to make that payment and relieve that obligation if the Summit Land Conservancy can raise another $200,000 by the end of this month. So it's crunch time. We are talking to everybody that we can. If people can come forth and make some contributions, then the family can make that payment and we can keep this opportunity alive. Because basically that was the most pressing need that the family had. The federal funding, we have a longer window in order to raise the matching funds for that. So if we can get over this March hurdle, then we have a longer window of opportunity where maybe we can find an agreement with the county or find the remaining $3 million somewhere else.
So why isn't it the family can't just take a loan for $3.2 million?
You know, there's a limit. There, in all things, there is a limit and there's a hard line and there's places that people just can't go. I mean, that's kind of where we are, even with the negotiations between the family and the county. Both parties kind of feel like, wow, I can't go beyond that. And so there's a, you know, there's people have to kind of come to the table and we have to work through it and see what we can do.
Okay. So what is the deadline then?
So the deadline for funding for the last $200,000 is the end of this month, because then we will need to make a down payment to the family on the conservation easement. And this is the way we had structured this transaction all along. And it's the same way we've structured other transactions, including the one that we did with the Oscar Thorpe family on their 120 acres in Round Valley. So there's a down payment, and then there's the final payment a year and a half or so later. So it's not a different type of transaction. It's we had hoped to be able to make the full $5.5 million by the end of February, but that doesn't look like we'll be able to do that.
Yeah, so could you pull money? I mean, could you pull $200,000 from another fund?
We're looking at everything we have. You know, we do have reserved funds and things like that, but boy, to put that kind of funding into it would be a big policy decision that our board would have to look at very closely.
Yeah. So if the deal is not kept alive, what happens then to all of the funds that people have made for this? I mean, if this doesn't get purchased, do I get my money back?
Yes, you do. You get your money back. So, you know, and even after we've made the down payment, if something happens and we don't, you know, complete the deal, which is pretty unlikely, then there is a way for the Summit Land Conservancy to recover the money that it put into it and to repay the donors. So if you, you know, if for some reason it doesn't happen, then we will refund donors' money. That's the same promise that we made with Bonanza Flat as well. So again, this is not entirely unusual. This happens. I think it's really important to understand, though, that, you know, because people say, well, it's such a small difference now between where the family is and where the county is. And I think it's really important to understand that people who want to put conservation easements on their ground, on their property, are extraordinary. And they have a really deep sense of their land. And when they look at their farms or their fields, they're not just seeing farms and fields. They're seeing grandpa out there. And they're hearing things that their parents said to them. A long time ago, Anita Lewis, who is the assistant county manager and whose family put a conservation easement on a 4,500-acre ranch, said to me that she remembered, as a child growing up, she remembered her grandparents and parents struggling every year to pay the mortgage on that ranch and working so hard to keep that ranch in the family, so that when it finally came to her, she felt that she didn't have the right to sell it, because there was this huge legacy and all that work that her family had put into it. So, you know, when people say, wow, why can't the family do this or that? It's, you know, this is a legacy for them. And it's not just dirt.
Right. So it's 186 acres. Is that what we're...
158 acres. And I think the other thing that I've heard people say is, well, the county's demanding recreational access and the family won't give it. And that's not true either. We have always known that recreational access was a requirement of county funding, and have made several different offers of how that recreational access might be achieved. So, and that's still really what's under discussion.
So any opportunity, you just pull 20 acres out, sell that, and then raise the $2 million?
It would require, there's all kinds of opportunities if we can extend the life of the transaction, right? We've got a couple of weeks, 3 weeks left before the end of the month. If we aren't able to, if the family's not able to make this down payment or make this, relieve themselves of this burden that they inherited, basically, because, you know, the patriarch signed something that, anyway, if we can keep the transaction alive, then all kinds of things are possible. You know, we're floating all kinds of ideas. The Summit Land Conservancy is floating all kinds of ideas to everybody out there. So, but really, we need another $200,000 by the end of this month, and then we'll need another $3 million to get it across the finish line.
Yeah. So have you wrung people dry? I mean, given all of the things that we've tried to do, whether it was Dog Holler, Bonanza Flat, now the Oscar Thorpe Ranch.
You know, that's a good question. I think that people will donate when they care greatly about the property. And I think we find that people who are maybe closer or have a more a regular connection to a piece of land are more likely to participate. And I think, you know, people should give to what's important to them.
Okay. People can find out more by going on
WeSaveLand.org.
Okay. Cheryl, thanks.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox, the Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. This is the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:20. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Council meeting in work session Wednesday at the County Courthouse starting at 1:15. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So thanks for standing by. Real quick, In terms of our conversation, my conversation with Cheryl Fox just now, has the county offered its last best offer?
Well, I mean, over the last few months, the county has made several written offers, and I think the one that is there now is, and we're waiting for a response from. Is the current offer, and we'll see what happens with that. We have not, to my knowledge, gotten any official response from that yet, and I think the council is still waiting to hear back from that.
It sounded like from Cheryl, though, the family, that's not acceptable, so it sounds like it's kind of a deal at this point.
I can't represent that.
Yeah. They need $200,000. Could the county offer up $200,000 so they can at least, so we have at least a year to talk about it?
Well, I mean, I think that the offer that the county has made is the offer that's out there. You know, the values that the county council is trying to portray and reflect in those offers is still are still valid, and you know, unless we come to agreement on the rest of those points, I'm not sure that that's a viable option. But we haven't been approached on that either.
Okay, let's move on to the agenda. The council getting a legislative update. The packet lists some of the bills that the county supports. Funding for new voting equipment. Aren't we doing vote by mail now?
We are, but there's still equipment, obviously, that is involved with the counting of those ballots. And that's what that is. What the Clerks Association, in conjunction with the Lieutenant Governor's Office, is working on. And so they're working diligently to make sure that between counties and the state, we're able to fund that equipment across the state.
Okay. Also supporting people, allowing people to register to vote when obtaining or renewing their driver's license. That sounds like an easy one. Amusement park ride safety standards. I guess this would affect the county fair.
It certainly would affect the county fair. You know, so it's just something we're watching. As it goes through, it seems like a pretty much a no-brainer as far as protecting the public and protecting those that are riding those rides.
Right, and then there's also some legislation that would encourage renewable energy. At the same time, we also see legislation that would increase registration fees for electric vehicles. So I think we've got something on either side of the issue, huh?
Well, and with most legislative sessions, that seems to be the case. We're following both of those closely to see how they affect us and affect the goals of the council. I'm not sure how much will play into the eventual how those play out, but certainly we're watching them and seeing what UAC does as well.
Yeah, there's also a couple from lawmaker Mike Noel curbing Salt Lake City's authority over the watershed in the canyons. Why does the county oppose this?
Well, I mean, first of all, it speaks somewhat to local government control, which we are always supportive of in its broadest sense. But you know, watersheds are important to local government. We're the ones that are responsible for providing culinary water. And I think also it ties in closely with some of our work with the Central Wasatch Commission and some of the land protection that the county has supported in that effort.
There's also a bill stipulating that a government entity cannot support a federal designation without support from the state legislature. I'm guessing this has something to do with perhaps our National Monuments, Bears Ears, and the Escalante National Monument. But does it also affect the Central Wasatch Commission's efforts?
I think it certainly could. That's one of the reasons we're interested in it. Certainly what we tried to work with Congressman Bishop's office over the last few years is another interest of ours. I think mainly it seems to be somewhat of some overreach in regards to what individuals within government and government agencies at the local level especially could do and what we're allowed to do. It seems cumbersome to have to go to the state legislature every time that we would want to make comments about or participate in anything that has to do with federal land.
And one we haven't heard a lot about, but this is really fascinating to me. They're talking about an oversight committee that could investigate and require the governor to revoke a local regulation unless certain conditions are met. This one sounds like Big Brother, yeah?
You know, I haven't read that one specifically, so I'd want to wait until I did that. But in the way you describe it, yes, that does sound, if it reads that way, that it would be troubling.
That's House Bill 175 if people are interested. Also, there's a proposal to take jail reimbursement funds and distribute them equally among the 29 counties. It sounds to me that this would be a good news for the county, no? You'd receive more or no?
Well, I mean, of course, it's in the analysis of the details of that. If in fact we were to receive more for that, that might be a good thing. But you know, if it has, we have to look at it as a statewide system too of jails and holding facilities to see where it would help and where it would hurt. You know, we all share in that burden in some way or another. So we need to look at it as a sheriff's association as well.
Kind of like jail equalization here, huh?
Yeah. Could be termed that way, yeah.
Increasing the transient room tax, a proposal for that from 0.32% to 0.5%. I guess given the new split with the Chamber Bureau, that could be good news, but the county feels like it could negatively impact our tourist economy?
Well, this would be a state TRT. It would increase the state TRT, not the local or the, I mean, not the county or the city. It's not in relation to that. So, you know, one of the issues we have with raising a state transient room tax is, you know, currently the 0.32%, I believe, is dedicated towards recreation, which is called out in our TRT laws specifically as a use. You know, moving it into transportation funding then creates kind of an excess issue in our mind. And so we're going to see how that gets debated in committee.
Also, the council is scheduled to go down Thursday to the Capitol for County Government Day. Anything in particular that happens there? Just an opportunity to meet with the local representatives?
Yeah, it's certainly that opportunity. It's also an opportunity for all of the council members to meet with each other, get kind of the full update from the Utah Association of Counties on what they're pushing, what they're seeing in the legislature after the first couple of weeks. And then we get to sit down with our legislators again, and as we've done over the past few weeks, to reinforce our viewpoints in regards to some of these issues. That's the main focus of it, and just to kind of blast the legislature with county viewpoints for a day.
You'll also get an update, or the council will get an update, from the Kimball Junction Neighborhood Blue Ribbon Committee. Among the items mentioned here are an enhanced civic center around the Richens Building and Transit Center. What does this mean?
Well, it's just a part of the look of this committee was to look at what uses might be appropriate in that area. Being that Kimball Junction is one of the busiest areas of our county, both from a residential and a commercial standpoint, it would make sense that, you know, given that we have a transit center there, a lot of convergence of transportation, plus a library and a meeting space, that we would look at the future of that and see if more civic space was needed in the future. So that's the main focus of that bullet.
There's also mention of a multimodal possible aerial connection between the transit center and the Utah Olympic Park. So we're talking a chairlift, a cabriolet, something like that. And how come?
It could be something like that. Yeah, I mean, simply it would allow us to do something other than single occupancy vehicle or road transportation. It provides a look at an alternative. It centers on kind of the traditional transportation for those types of sports venues. So we'll see if there's an opportunity there. We want to leave it open to a lot of different transportation methods to move people up and down the mountain.
And is that like in preparation for bidding for the future Olympic Games?
I think everything is in consideration for the future of the Utah Olympic Park and the Legacy Foundation. Certainly, it could be in conjunction with an Olympics, but we're really looking at the viability of that asset in our community.
All right. We've been talking about forever about an interstate overpass there at the McDonald's intersection. Is that in the plan?
Well, certainly what the group has talked about is the kind of the northwest or north-south flow of traffic on 224. As it interacts with I-80 and then the east-west traffic between the two sides of 224. We know in talks with UDOT during this process, because they were involved with this as well, that we need to project improvements in that area in the future, because that's one of our biggest bottlenecks in the county right now as far as vehicular traffic. So we certainly want to project a strong statement on that, and then that will be carried into our transportation plan to see what we can do with UDOT in the future to improve those situations.
And then real quickly, another Blue Ribbon Committee, this one on remote parking. The staff report mentions three spots in particular, the Eckerd Hill Park and Ride, which sounds like it's the most feasible, Richardson Flat, which staff seems to feel is the least likely, just it's more of an employee special event lot, and then the Tech Center, which would fit with the Transit Center. But you would have to make some changes to make that happen, no?
We certainly would. I mean, although the Tech Center itself contemplated a certain amount of parking and then density based on parking availability. So it that area has talked about that issue before. Mainly, the issue on the west side of the of 224 is simply to have a place for cars not to have to get on 224 to get into our main areas of Park City and our ski areas. And so the Tech Center in that area is a possibility. Certainly, as you've identified, Eckerd Hill is a place that we've already been working on with UDOT on and is another possibility. As well as since that committee met, the Klein-Dolly parcel was certainly looked at, but without the improvements to the interchange, which they didn't know at the time was committed, that's a viable or less viable based on that project. So, it's mainly these possibilities are based on availability and their ability to help move people out of their vehicles into transit in order to enter our 224 corridor.
Okay. Hey, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. It's 8:30. Well, last month, the Wasatch County Council voted once again to allow a rezone of the Northfields from one unit per 20 acres to one home per 5 acres. On the phone to talk about that, as well as get an update on other issues in Wasatch County, I have Manager Mike Davis. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So with regard to the Northfields rezone, I thought voters put a stop to this with the referendum petition that was passed 3 years ago in 2016, then the council voting 4-2 last month to approve it. So are we talking about just one parcel, or was the referendum for the entire Northfields?
Actually, the parcel isn't in the Northfields. It's the area called the Southfields. It's about half mile to the south of the Northfields area. The Northfields is defined as the area north of Midway Lane, the road that goes to Midway, and this is south of that. It's down kind of by the County Event Center.
So,
but it was in the same planning area. There's a large planning area for the general plan that had this planning area that included that area. And at the time, what the council said in the change was that they were looking at that because they didn't feel that Southfields area they were looking to change into the zone on to be included in the 20-acre zoning. That was their feeling on.
So this vote will allow the property owner to do what exactly?
It would change it from one home per 20 acres to one home per 5 acres.
So if citizens want to put a stop to this, they would have, I think, a month or something to collect signatures to what? Put another referendum on the ballot to overturn that vote?
That is correct. And I've heard that there is an individual that has started a referendum. So I will have to wait and see if they get the necessary signatures to put it on the ballot.
Wasatch County recently put together an open space committee, and I guess I'm just kind of scratching my head. Why would the county council approve something like this, essentially quadrupling the value of the property when it hopes to buy part of the Northfields? Didn't the council just shoot itself in the foot here?
Well, it's not the Northfields. It's about a half mile away from the Northfield. But the properties all around this parcel are zoned currently 5 acres. And so So the line that's there is not a straight line that comes from the river up to Southfield Road area. And the three sides of the property are zoned for 5 acres, 5 acre lots, and this one parcel is zoned for a 20 acre lot. And that's why they felt it would fit in, because they're already building 5 acre homes right around this lot. And it's, like I say, it's about a half mile south of where the Northfield is. It's not technically in the Northfield.
Okay. But, I mean, you could make that argument. I mean, as you keep approving 1 per 5, I mean, eventually it's going to get up against the boundaries of 1 per 20 at some point, no?
That is true. And that, I believe that's the argument of some of the people that attended the meeting, and their concern with that. But there are, in that area, there are many of the homes that are on 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 acre lots in that area. In fact, many of the people that came to the hearing live on smaller lots. They don't live on the larger lots, but this lot is adjacent to theirs, and they'd like to keep it 20 acres. So that's the dilemma and the discussion.
Okay. Real quick, any news from the MIDA, the military authority, to build their military hotel there at the Mayflower site?
Yes. We have heard some things. In the legislative session last year, MIDA was allowed to borrow out of the UDOT fund for infrastructure construction, and so they are proceeding to do that, to construct the Jordanelle Parkway, which is the road that will go essentially from the Mayflower exit along the lake over to the Browns Canyon, where the Browns Canyon Road takes off of 248. So that is in progress right now. We're working through the engineering and the plats and the recordings to get that started. And they anticipate starting this sometime this spring.
Yeah, so has MIDA decided which site it's going to build on? Or are they still in that environmental study?
I have not been informed of that. I know they are looking at a couple different sites. I think what they're waiting for is the developer is proceeding with the NEPA process to ensure that the property meets environmental standards for them to be able to accept the property. The government, the federal government in particular, so the armed services, cannot accept property that has not been has not gone through the NEPA process, and so they anticipate to have that done. What I'm hearing is sometime before June.
Okay. With a winter like this one, not a lot of snow, are there enough water rights with this development to make snow? I mean, we've got certainly northern elevation there, but certainly low elevation as well.
Right, and I'm sure that will be a challenge. There are a lot of water rights associated with the properties that are in question. But that doesn't mean that during a particular year there's enough water within those rights to necessarily do everything you want to do. And so that certainly will be a concern. The elevation's a little bit lower there. They are trying to develop on the north-facing slope for the ski infrastructure. So I'm not the engineer on it, but my understanding is they feel they can make it work. All right, they're still running the Deer Crest gondola at this time. They're making snow and able to run it. I don't know if it's bad enough that it's close to closing or if it's doing okay. I just don't know. But I know there's a lot of people up there skiing off of Deer Crest gondola.
And real quick, an update on the Jordanelle Special Service District. Have all of the lawsuits and foreclosures there been settled?
Yes, we settled those lawsuits. It's been almost 2 years. And in fact, the properties that were associated with the suit just sold within the last month. So my guess is that the people that bought that, we haven't seen the plan yet, but we suspect they'll be in with a development plan shortly. And that purchase then took out all of the bondholders, and they accepted that. But the settlement was that they would accept those properties, which was the original agreement, and they then had the opportunity to sell the property and then collect the proceeds, and it went that way, so it looks like we're done.
And all of this was as a result of building a sewer treatment plant that never went into operation, so they couldn't collect the fees on it. So when does that actually get turned on?
Well, what happened on that was that the landowners wanted to develop and they needed a sewer plant. So they agreed to build the plant, but then they never built any homes to feed the plant. And so as soon as the homes are built, they will be directed into the plant. They're actually looking at expanding the plant now because the developments up from the Extel sites, the Mayflower sites, and so forth, are looking to feed into that plant as well, and they'll have to expand the capacity. So it hasn't even turned on, and they're looking at making it bigger. But they're looking at all of those scenarios right now, and that was a part of the big part of the sale was the capacity. The plant was owned by the landowner. They wanted to keep that because that's essentially to develop. They need that capacity. So they own all the capacity of the plant at this point. And so as Extel develops, they'll need to increase the capacity to use the plant. We see that happening probably in the next couple of years.
Okay. Hey, Mike, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis. The Mexican Consulate in Salt Lake City is an official branch of the Mexican government that offers services to Mexican citizens in America. The head consul, Jose Borron, has arrived in Salt Lake City last June. In the last few months, he's been traveling across the state in a diplomacy effort, specifically working with Rotary clubs in different cities to spread the word about Mexicans living in Utah. He's coming to Park City Thursday night. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Consul.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So you have undertaken a public outreach initiative to get to know the different areas of Utah and the needs of Mexicans living here. What have you learned so far?
Well, what I've learned is that we have a vibrant population that is working and studying and contributing to the prosperity of the state, which is thriving economically, and that I've learned that there's a lot of interesting and partnerships throughout the state, and there's a lot of people who are interested in helping our population integrate and have a better way of life, and that's something which is great, which talks great about the people of Utah and how they're looking forward to work with immigrants, refugees from other countries, and I think that is the way we would like to have it done throughout the United States.
Yeah, you've been to Salt Lake area Rotary clubs. Yesterday, you were down in St. George. What concerns have you heard from these different communities?
Well, obviously, each community can have its own specific concerns. But what I've sensed so far is that there is obviously an understanding of the importance of the Latino population in the state, of the Mexican origin population, of youth. And there's a need for working together for their development, English language acquisition, participation in civic activities in schools, school districts. And there's always an interest in helping, but we need to find specific initiatives. And that's something that, for example, as I talk with different Rotary clubs, I see there are many great projects at a local level that will have a resonate with our community.
Right. Now, are those the same challenges that you would hear from Mexicans themselves? I mean, because when you're talking with Rotary clubs, you're talking with business leaders, right?
Yes. And that's part of my engagement and trying to talk with many different members of the community. Obviously, when I talk with members of my community, the requests are a little bit different. They're much more specific into documentation needs and immigration advice. But we need to see this also in a larger perspective if we are working into integrating all communities. And that's why I think it's very relevant that we have a conversation with leadership like the Rotary clubs members who are have a service-oriented attitude, and we are also as a consulate a civil service, and so there's a lot of opportunities for partnership in addressing the different needs of the community.
Yeah, do you hear though from you know, from Mexicans living in Utah that they feel maybe undervalued and that they're more takers than producers? Because, you know, for those of us who witness it here in Park City, you know, I mean, any of us who know Latinos know that they work at least two jobs.
Exactly. I think it's that's part also of my conversation with when I go out and reach out to members of the community, in this case, for example, Rotary clubs, just to make aware of how Latinos are contributing to this state, to its wealth, not only at a national level, but also at a state and local level. You very well said the example of Park City, and then it's not different from St. George, Cedar, or Logan, wherever you want to put as an example how Mexican community members are working two, three shifts and having their children go to school and you know, develop their potentials. And that's always so important to remind our friends and partners in the community so that an adequate vision of how Mexican immigrants are working and contributing to this state is carried across. I think it's much more relevant in the last year.
Yeah, do you think the challenges of Mexicans living in Park City are different from other communities, just given the high cost of living here?
I do think that that's a very good example. The issue of living, which is very particularly evident in Park City, that makes certain challenges much more evident. Obviously, being a city that has a lot of tourists and the costs for living and affordable home, it is a great challenge. So that's very particular there. Then we have obviously several similar challenges like access to education, healthcare, and transportation, which can be resonated throughout the different cities of the state. I think what will be interesting as I approach and discuss with members of the community is what are the initiatives that are being developed locally to address these challenges, how, as we work together, consulate, members of the community, we can contribute to our well-being in the Park City area, and this way recognize the value of Mexican immigrants as they work and study and live in the area.
So what services does the consulate provide to Mexican nationals?
We basically have three main areas of services. The first one would be documentation. We issue them their Mexican passports, matricula card, which is a ID card from the consulate, birth certificates, notary powers. Then we have another area of legal and protection, which is focused in giving them advice on immigration issues, legal issues, family law, and trying to see what are the circumstances and if there are cases that we need to file with local authorities that we can guide them adequately for their protection. And there's a third level of service, which is the community development area, where we will work through partnerships with the community organizations, school districts, faith-based organizations, in developing specific programs in the area of education, health, financial literacy, community integration. And that's obviously some of the most dynamic areas in the consulate, with this idea of being much more than just an office for documents, you know, trying to help integrate our community. That's a little bit the mission in the long term.
Yeah. So it's been a year since President Trump took office and almost immediately instituted changes in the immigration policy. Has that affected at all what you do at the consulate?
Yes, it has. The political discourse that comes from Washington, D.C. resonates at all levels. And locally, it is no exception. We have seen an increase, for example, on request of birth certificates for those Mexicans born here in the U.S., for Mexican parents to year we had an increase of around 500%, and this was not because of a sudden interest in having dual citizenship, but because of a fear that has grown in the community and on what will happen with them, their family members. So people are taking certain steps to get ready for whatever could happen. And that's also part of the necessity of going out in the community and starting this dialogues and conversations through the different communities so that we can really help to, at a local level, which is obviously our main and only area of importance and work, is how can we work better in the community and those who are studying, working, having their families here, and they should keep their lives going on and being a good citizen and, you know, following rules and regulations. And that's the message that we want to transmit across the board to alleviate these fears and obviously recognizing how political discourse can have a local effect in the communities.
Okay. You'll be at the Jim Sani Auditorium again this Thursday night starting at 6 o'clock. There'll be a short reception, then you'll make a presentation on the consulate services and then take questions from the audience. Is this for Mexicans or is this for Americans?
Actually, it is open to all. Fortunately, we are doing this through our partnership with the Rotary Club members. So we focused on engaging all members of the Rotary Clubs, but we want this to be a conversation that is inclusive. So any member of a Mexican community can also come. And this way we can also work into this objective of trying to partner between Rotaries and how to develop more initiatives oriented for Latino youth and professionals.
Okay. That's the head consul of the Mexican consulate in Salt Lake City, Jose Barón. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
The Park City Institute will be celebrating the 20th anniversary of Eve Ensler's groundbreaking play, The Vagina Monologues, with a performance by local women this Sunday. Directing the production is Babs DeLay. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Babs.
Hey, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So you have done this before, directed the Vagina Monologues. And I guess luckily for our citizen actresses, there's no memorization required. They'll be reading from a script. So how are you helping in this effort?
Directing the nuances and the timing is really important in the play. And just putting the whole thing together, it's such an amazing play. I have to step back maybe 20 years when I replaced Roma Downey in the touring Broadway show here in Utah. And when they told me that I was going to get this show, I hadn't tried out for it. I was no local actor or anything. But some friends were producing it. And they said, okay, you got the part. And I thought to myself, am I going to have to perform naked, which I don't want to do? And am I going to have to memorize anything? Because I can't physically, mentally do that. Neither happened, and it's been a success in Utah for 19 years now with hundreds of production shows that have raised, I'd say in Utah, almost $300,000, $400,000 for local shelters and rape recovery centers.
Wow. So how many women are involved in this Sunday's production?
The cast is changing as we speak. We could be adding here momentarily. I know that I'm doing a production all week down in Salt Lake with the Women of Westminster, and we have, I think, 30 people in the cast down here. And Park City won't be as big, and that means that the women actors will be having more time to talk on stage, which is fun because they can get more into their characters and the change of characters.
Yeah. Now, do they get to pick their characters, or do you assign them?
Actually, they get some reading. Terry Orr is helping. She's helping figure out who's got the right personality for the right part. So I'll walk in and just be smiling from ear to ear as to who's there and what they're going to do.
Right. How many rehearsals are scheduled?
The beautiful part about this play is that it's readings, and it's readings from real women. And so it doesn't take that much to rehearse it. I would say we have two or three rehearsals, and it's really more about timing and making sure a lot of the words are pronounced correctly. Some of the pieces talk about places in foreign countries that you might not be familiar with.
Yeah, and still 20 years later, this just rings still so true. What does it have, this lasting endurance?
Well, right now, this program is supporting over 12,000 shelters around the world because of the funds that come in from these hundreds and hundreds of productions that take place every February around the world. It's as relevant today as it was 20 years ago. These shelters aren't getting any more money from our legislators. These shelters are needed in areas of conflict that don't have shelters, or those shelters have been blown up. And I would say that we need these desperately.
Well, again, this is a fundraiser for Park City's Peace House. The mixer starts at 6:30, the performance at 7:30. It's happening at the Kimball Arts Center, not the Eccles Center. Tickets are $50, available by calling the box office 435-655-3114. Hey, Babs, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a great day.